This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and develop your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. In this episode, we talk with Scott Hamilton, the editor of Leeham News and Comment, about Solar Impulse 2, Bombardier in the C-Series, Boeing in the 737 MAX, as well as a 787 engine AD, Airbus and A321 assembly in Alabama, and a lot more. Scott doesn't disappoint, and he doesn't mince words. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 398 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. Joining me is first the other Max, Max Trescott. He's a certified flight instructor, an author, and a glass cockpit expert. Max T, how are you?
Oh, I am awesome. How are you doing?
Very well. Now, we understand that you were up a little bit late the other night to view something very interesting that we're going to talk about in just a few minutes.
Oh, man, was I so lucky. Yes, indeed. I did hang out at Moffett Field late a couple of nights ago, and I'm just about to email you a whole bunch of pictures.
All right. We're going to talk about that soon. But first, let's introduce Rob Mark. He's also a pilot and flight instructor. He's an aviation journalist and publisher of the Jetwine blog. Back to us this week after, well, I guess nursing the flu last week. Rob, how you feeling?
Well, I wasn't nursing it. It was nursing me, and it didn't do – well, let's just say it wasn't very nice to me. So it's nice to be back.
Great to have you back. Also joining us is our aviation historian, David Vanderhoof, off the edge of the Philly runway. And David, you're just back from an exciting adventure yourself.
Yeah, I had a fantastic 2 days down at Langley Air Force Base and NASA Langley Research Center, but more about that later. But okay. It was a good trip. It was a really good trip.
Great. Fantastic. We're all envious and can't wait to hear more about it. Brian Coleman is off this week. He's in Germany, so he's on his own little adventure, and we'll look forward to hearing from him again soon, hopefully next week. But let's introduce our guest for this episode. It's Scott Hamilton. He's the editor of Leeham News and Comment. Now, Scott's known in the industry for his straight shooting, call it like it is, take on news and events. He's frequently called on by broadcast and print media to offer expert analysis about the issues of the day. Scott's also a regular speaker at aviation conferences and corporate events. Leeham News and Comment regularly breaks international news that wire services and other media pick up. Scott, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. I think you like being first to break the story.
Well, I do, and thank you for having me. I do enjoy breaking news ahead of your traditional media, both in the mainstream press, as some of the politicians call it, and the trade press. But, you know, I get a little kick out of that.
Very good. All right. Well, we're going to launch right into the aviation news for the past week. So is everyone ready?
Yeah.
Ready from the West.
Our first story comes from CNN. Solar Impulse 2 lands in California after a Pacific flight. Well, as I think everyone knows, the Solar Impulse 2 had to lay over in Hawaii for almost 10 months for repairs. Solar Impulse 2, piloted by Bertrand Piccard, landed in Mountain View, California, just before midnight a few days ago. The flight lasted just over 62 hours. Max Trescott, you witnessed the arrival, didn't you?
Oh, boy, was I lucky. You and I had interviewed Andre Borschberg last summer, I guess, after he completed the leg to Hawaii.
Yes.
And from that contact, I then arranged for him to come visit the Aero Club in Northern California in September. And so we got to know each other. And lo and behold, last week, within a day after the takeoff, I got an email out of the blue, which was addressed to a couple of dozen people saying, hey, you're invited to the landing. So I was really quite thrilled. We were able to bring along five people from the Aero Club in Northern California. And originally we were told somewhere around 7 p.m., which sounded pretty good. And then soon after that, we were told 11 o'clock or midnight. And it turns out that the winds really kicked up here in the last few days. The aircraft, the Solar Impulse, is a very, very spindly aircraft. It's got a wingspan of 208 feet. So about the wingspan of a 747, yet it only weighs about 5,000 pounds, so kind of a heavy automobile. So it's very, very, very fragile, and they really were looking to avoid any turbulence coming in here. Now, the interesting thing is, when we talked with Andre last year, the plan at that point was to fly to Phoenix from Hawaii, and in speaking with the airport manager at Moffett Field that night, he told me that they had only heard about a week ahead of time that the plan had changed. So we don't really know why the plan changed. But I can't tell you that Google is one of the sponsors. Their logo is on the side of the Solar Impulse this time around. Sergey Brin, one of the founders of Google, was there with roughly 200 people who welcomed the aircraft. So I don't know if it was just because they wanted to get coverage here in Silicon Valley, or if it's the fact that this part of the country is 200 miles closer than Southern California is to Hawaii. But for whatever reason, they decided to come here. They did land just shortly before midnight. It was really quite a sight. I just emailed you a link to some photos that I took, and I know we'll put those into the show notes, but it's pretty spectacular to see that big long string of lights along the leading edge of their wingspan as it was headed down the runway. And then after that, they pushed the aircraft with a ground crew apparently it's not towable. They use about a dozen people to, to push it from one place to another. And then Bertrand came out, did some interviews with the media, then he talked to the crowd. And basically, it was a really fun time had by all. We wrapped up about 1 o'clock in the morning and headed off.
So it just stops on the runway, and then they kind of pull it to wherever they're headed?
Yes. It looked to me like they may have attached some type of support for the tail to it before they moved. I couldn't really tell for sure. But it's interesting. It's free castering, because initially they were pushing it forward, and then they just started pushing it sideways. So they can, they can maneuver it quite easily. And I did see one photo today on the CNN website that showed it going into the mobile hangar. The mobile hangar is a pressurized kind of plastic cocoon. And so they just set that up and then pushed the plane in sideways along the wingspan axis into it, and then sealed up. Good thing, because yesterday we had winds gusting to 40 miles an hour around here, and you certainly don't want a plane outside in that kind of wind.
Mm. Especially something that large and in that light.
Oh, yes.
How strong did you say the winds were that they were wrestling with on the ground there, Max?
Sure. So we had a small little trough come through here, and the winds, picked up just about the time they were arriving. And so the winds had died down to 6 knots at the surface, but they were at 15 knots on downwind as they were, coming into Moffett. I was listening live to the conversations with Bertrand as he was talking to the control center in Monaco. So that's how I was able to hear exactly what they were experiencing. And Bertrand did comment that they were definitely picking up some turbulence. Now, they had hung out all afternoon off the coast waiting for the winds to die down. And Andre was up in a helicopter circling him over the Golden Gate Bridge. So there are just a lot of great photos that were shot over San Francisco that afternoon.
I think the next leg is to some place in the middle of the United States, but I don't think they've actually said what the destination is. Have you heard anything about that, Max?
You are correct. Originally, they said it was going to go to Phoenix, but they've been very noncommittal since they arrived here. The only thing that they've said for sure is that they will arrive in New York, but they haven't announced what the intermediate stops are between here and New York. So I think they're just constantly evaluating the weather and trying to figure out what's going to make the most sense.
Ah, okay.
Can you see that thing going into LaGuardia? Yeah. Okay. Yo, yeah, baby, your number is 7-4-4 right, and keep speed up. And how fast? You can do 30? Okay.
That's a really good question. Where would they bring it in? Would they bring it in Teterboro, or where would you bring it in if you're going to New York?
The Hudson?
No. Yeah. Maybe Essex County or Morristown or something.
No, I don't know. It's a good point. I doubt they would do Teterboro because I don't think they would want to disrupt all that corporate traffic. I mean, Teterboro trust me, Teterboro is a hornet's nest when you're on an IFR flight plan and you're number six for the approach. But that kind of an airplane that has limited maneuverability and it's going to be a mess when it gets on the ground. Boy, I sure wouldn't take it to Teterboro.
And the last time they took it to JFK from Dulles. So I'm sure it'll go into JFK again.
That's right.
That makes sense when you think about the wingspan. You know, I was saying Caldwell or Morristown, but I don't think you could, have an airplane maneuvering around. There's probably no room to put up the mobile hangar and store it there either.
Right. Well, of course, you can follow the journey at solarimpulse.com. They've got a lot of interesting material there. Very easy to follow the flights. And so that's the place you should go to learn more about the next legs and what's coming up with that flight. Well, let's switch gears a little bit and sort of kick off a little bit of a Bombardier C-Series theme. Maybe we can start with a couple of items that were in Liam News. The CS-30, of course, was designed to be the base model, with the CS-100 being a shrink. Now, some wonder if there could be a stretch version or a CS-500 that could seat more passengers and maybe would be a little bit better sized for airline needs. Scott, what do you think about that? Do you think that we'll see a stretched C-Series?
Well, it's certainly technically feasible. The wing is big enough. You would lose a little range, just like when Boeing stretched the 787 to the Dash 10 model. It was what they would call a simple stretch, basically just fuselage plugs, and they lost some range on it. And that's basically what Bombardier would do with the CS-500. They would lose a few hundred miles range over the CS-300 because it would be just really a fuselage plug. They'd have to do a few more things to affect the rotation of the airplane on takeoff. But it's certainly technically feasible. Now, is the market there? I think eventually it would be. You're seeing Boeing and Airbus inch upwards as they look at their forward-looking airplanes. The heart of the market right now is considered to be around 160 passengers, but it's inching upwards. And as Boeing and Airbus would design new airplanes, they'd kind of lose the 150-seat market segment because you'd have to have two airplanes, and they're not going to do that. So that would leave an opportunity for Bombardier to have the CS-500 to fill in that area just below the Boeing and Airbus. So then the next question is, can Bombardier afford it? And right now the answer is no.
Yeah.
A
little cash flow would help support development of another. Yeah.
And they're going to have a negative cash flow with the C-Series for the next probably 5 years. It'd be 2020 before they start to see positive cash flow as they ramp up production, as they start delivering airplanes and so on. So if they were to launch a CS-500, I think that it would not be until an entry into service or EIS until 2022 maybe, which would be about the time that Airbus and Boeing would be seriously looking at their next airplane.
Sure, sure. Now, of course, we always look forward to additional orders for the C-Series aircraft, and Delta has been in the news a lot recently, possibly about ready to announce some aircraft orders, maybe some more A321s, and maybe an order for 75 small narrow bodies. I think the press, most people have been considering that to be a possibility, these narrow bodies for the C-Series, but Embraer might be competitor for Delta's business in this class as well. What do you think about that, Scott?
The needs for Delta right now are more in the CS300 and the A321 category, and the Embraer is just too small. The E195E2 can seat 133 people maximum in a single coach configuration. And the C-Series, their CS300 is about 135 passengers in two class and 150 passengers in a single coach. And Delta would clearly want to have first in coach. So I don't see Embraer in the mix this time. And their Bombardier can actually offer earlier delivery slots for the CS300 than either Embraer could for its airplane or Airbus could for their airplanes. I think that that's certainly Bombardier should win this deal, and it could be announced as early as Friday. It might be next month, but we shall see.
Hmm. Delta has, I think, made it pretty clear that price is a big consideration here. And
it always is.
Yeah, of course. And I'm wondering if the current executive leadership at Bombardier is maybe a little bit more, well, let's say, flexible on pricing than has been the case in the past.
Oh, you are so kind. yes, the current leadership is much more flexible than the prior executive management, which couldn't sell a glass of water to a thirsty man in the middle of the Sahara Desert.
Oh, dear. yeah, you don't mince words, Scott. That's what we know about you.
Alain Bellemare, who came in to replace Pierre Beaudoin, part of the Bombardier family. Alain certainly knows how to do business with major airlines, and Beaudoin and his sales force, of course, was very good at doing business with regional airlines, but didn't know how to do business with major airlines. And Alain certainly is, and he brought in a team of people who certainly know how to deal with the world's global carriers. And that's one of the things they needed. Now, another thing that helps them is the fact that they took a $3.2 billion write-down last year of the C-Series program. And our analysis at Lehem News indicated that could shave $5 million off of the price of the airplane. So that gave them $5 million in pricing flexibility. And then a program that Alain Bellemare has put into effect called the Transformation Plan involves cutting costs across the entire enterprise. But with respect to the aerospace side, they brought in a fellow by the name of Nico Buchholz, who was the fleet planner of Lufthansa Airlines, and he was brought in as the chief procurement officer for the entire enterprise, and he hopes to be able to shave off a couple million dollars more in cost to produce the airplane, the C-Series, and also to breathe new life in the Q400 and the CRJ to give more pricing flexibility even there.
Hmm. I guess the mood at Bombardier should be pretty upbeat these days, given all these possibilities and these changes.
Well, I haven't really talked to people over at Bombardier for quite a while. They'll be upbeat when they really start landing orders after orders. You know, they in January announced an order for 45 firm, and I think it was 30 option with Air Canada. That has not yet been converted to a firm contract, but that's supposed to be pretty soon. Hmm. But we've been down this road many times before with Bombardier, where they thought that they were going to land a nice order, and then it was snatched away at the last minute. United Airlines is the latest example of that. There was a lot of anticipation that United would order the C-Series, and Boeing swooped in with a 737-700 deal for 65 airplanes that just blew Bombardier right out of the water, because even with the price adjustments, Bombardier couldn't begin to match that 737-700 price. So we've been down this road before. We'll see whether or not there's some last-minute transaction with somebody else that could blow them out at Delta, but we shall see.
Yes. Well, of course, we always watch for the reaction from Boeing and Airbus to Bombardier and their activities with the C-Series. And our friend John Ostrower penned an article just recently in the Wall Street Journal titled, Boeing Considering New 737 Model to Fend Off Bombardier Jet. Rob, did you see the picture of me, the photo of me with the 737 MAX test aircraft?
No.
Well, I'll have to show you that. So there's me, there's MAX and the MAX. Back to this article, John Ostrower describes how the smallest 737 MAX, the Dash 7 version, it's got 126 seats in a two-class configuration. But they've only got 60 firm orders for that model. That's out of, you know, several thousand orders. They've got 30 orders, 30 firm from Southwest, 25 from WestJet, and I think 5 from Canada Jetlines. Well, reportedly, Boeing is looking at a 150-seat model, a stretch. Internally, they're calling it the 737 MAX 7X. I don't know if this is a real possibility. When you look at the small number of firm orders, it does suggest that maybe Boeing needs to take a look at that particular model. But whether or not they're looking at moving up to something like a 150-seat MAX 7X, I don't know if it's serious or not.
Well, it is serious. They are looking at it. And one of the reasons they're looking at it is because the MAX 7 has been a sales dud. As you pointed out, only three carriers have ordered the airplane, and one of those is a startup that, for all I know, was never going to get off the ground. Southwest Airlines really wants the airplane for its operations at Midway Airport in particular, but also, as I understand, at Burbank Airport. I'm less clear about why WestJet wants it, unless it's just because some of the routes up there are in Canada are thin routes. That would make sense. But the airplane certainly has not sold at all well, and Boeing may be considering that this would enhance sales a little bit. But there's actually a technical argument here to be made too, and that is the let's remember that the MAX 7 is based on the 737-700, which of course is based on the 737-300, which is based on the 737-200, going really way back there. And as they stretched and created the 737-800, there's really some structural difference between the two airplanes. And if you actually go to the MAX 7X and you understand that this is really a shrink, not a growth airplane, it's a shrink of the MAX 8, now you're talking about an airplane that has common structures, and so from a production standpoint, it's much more efficient for Boeing to build a shrink rather than have a rather unique structure in the MAX 7 versus a structure in the MAX 8.
Interesting.
You know, Scott, I've got a question for you. I mean, just between us guys, how much longer do you think Boeing can keep noodling with the current 737 before they're going to be forced to build a new single-aisle airplane?
Well, my view is that that's what they should have done instead of inventing the MAX, but Airbus was very smart and mousetrapped them with the American Airlines order. You've got the MAX X, 7X that they're noodling with. They're also noodling with the 737 MAX 10, which is a stretch of the MAX 9, and that's an entirely different topic all unto its own. It's just real clear from the sales numbers, the MAX has seen its day, and until they can figure out, well, even if they go forward with a 737-10, even if they go forward with this 737-7X, the MAX family is really down to the MAX 8, and you've got some, half-sisters out there, so to speak. This family has run its course.
And of course, to go beyond that with something new or highly developed, you know, there again, you need the funding to support the development, and that's always a problem.
Well, I would argue that if you had different priorities, there's plenty of money. And do you know where that money is going today?
787.
Well, that too, but no, it's going to shareholder buyback at the tune of $6 billion a year. That would fund a lot of new airplane.
That's true. That's a lot of development funds.
You know, if you go to Boeing's website and go to the investors page, they proudly announce that they have bought back something like $60 billion worth of stock. Now, how many airplanes could that buy you? Yeah. Quite a few.
Yeah.
Hmm. Well, Scott, maybe you could tell our listeners, you know, in economic terms, what does that mean when a company like Boeing spend so much money to buy back stock? Why do they do it? And what's the, well, obviously we know one of the effects is that there's not money for new development, but what else does it give Boeing?
Well, it's all about shareholder value, which has been the mantra ever since the McDonnell Douglas family essentially acquired Boeing with Boeing's money and stock. It's all been about shareholder value. And you know, let's be clear, you do have to take care of your shareholders, but if you do that at the expense of developing good products, that means down the road, and it might be 10 years down the road, it might be 20 years down the road, you've robbed Peter to pay Paul. But the stated desire here by Boeing to give back to shareholders is because they had all those years where the 787 program just sucked the wind out of the sails there. And that's S-A-I-L-S, not S-A-L-E-S.
Right.
And just, you know, it's been a program that's got $32 billion in deferred costs to it. And that's just the inventory. That's not considering penalties to customers for late airplanes and airplanes that didn't meet their initial guarantees and so on. When you figure that in, I've seen one estimate of $50 billion. So having gone through those lean years and then you had the knock-on effect with the 747-8. That was delayed because engineers were retained by 787. Engineers were diverted from 47 to 87. And so that program became a technical debacle, quite frankly. Boeing figures that they need to kind of pay attention to their shareholders. The problem is they're now that's sucking so much cash down that there's no way that they are willing to green light a new airplane at this time.
Well, let's switch over to Airbus for a few minutes and talk about some of their activities in the United States. We've got a couple of things going on this week. I think just today as we record this, Airbus delivered the first A321 to JetBlue. And we also see that they had a first flight on the A321 that's destined for American. And this, of course, is out of their assembly plant in Mobile, Alabama. I think that that's probably a good strategic move for Airbus to create this facility in Alabama in the United States. I think it's something that they can leverage in the future for other opportunities.
It is. And let's go back in history a little bit. The whole idea of an assembly plant in Alabama, of course, was originally tied to the plan or to the bid to the Pentagon for the U.S. Air Force tanker to replace the Boeing KC-135s. Airbus had pledged that if they won that contract, then they would build an assembly plant in Mobile to assemble the what eventually became known as the KC-45 for the Air Force. Airbus, which had teamed with Northrop Grumman at the time, in fact, did win the contract, and so they started to make moves to proceed with the assembly plant. Then Boeing protested, the GAO upheld, the Pentagon reran the deal, and Boeing won that round. Having then lost that opportunity, Airbus went back home to Toulouse, and thought about it for a while and decided to go forward and make the Mobile an A320 assembly plant instead of the A330 KC-45 plant. And initially, the plant has the capacity for 8 A320s a month. They have plenty of ground around the plant that they could expand and, you know, really do whatever they want to do, including wide bodies should they desire to do that. And this certainly gives Airbus a more solid ground to go back to the Pentagon at some future date and say we're here, not that we're going to be here, and we now have the expertise, not that we're going to build the expertise. And there is at some point going to be another round of competition for the next set of tankers. You have the KC-10 that you have to replace. There are actually more KC-135s that will need to be replaced. And at the moment, Boeing has not performed at all well with the KC-46 development. They've already written off more than $1 billion pre-tax because of the problems they've had with the program, and they're late with the airplane. So, you know, Airbus is really looking well down the road in the future on this. And it's, of course, a very modern plant. It's very automated. So I think there's some real good opportunity down the road for Airbus.
The best quote that I've seen on this came from a Fortune article. The byline is Jeffrey Smith and Alan Murray. But the quote from the article is, another big twitch of the needle on the irony meter. Airbus will become eligible for financing from the U.S. Ex-Im Bank when it delivers its first jet from its new factory in Alabama.
Isn't that sweet revenge there? You know, Boeing has been working to renew the Ex-Im Bank authority. They finally actually did get it renewed, but then the Republicans in the Senate won't approve the appointees to the Ex-Im Board of Directors, so they don't have a quorum and they can't approve anything over $10 million right now. And further irony, two of the strongest opponents to Ex-Im Bank are Alabama Senators Shelby and Sessions.
Oh, dear.
But there is always the chance that the Airbus people might be able to take some of those redundant Boeing employees that they're going to get rid of. Who knows, huh?
Yeah.
Well, I've actually suggested to Alan McCarter, the chairman of Airbus Americas, that they do a job fair up here in Seattle and go after all of those engineers Boeing's going to lay off.
Yeah, I think that might represent a good source of employees for Airbus if they need them.
Alan got a laugh out of it, but he said he didn't plan to do that anytime soon.
Okay. All right, another item we've seen in the news recently, this from CNN, FAA orders urgent engine fixes for Boeing 787 Dreamliners. Just briefly, in January, General Electric GE NX-1B engine had to be shut down in flight after that engine experienced excessive vibration. What happened was ice came off of a fan blade, caused an imbalance of the fan that led to, quote, substantial damage after the fan blade tips started rubbing on the fan case. And so the FAA has issued an AD, an airworthiness directive, that requires either repairs to the engine or you have to have one of the two engines being an older model. The newer engine that's apparently subject to this fan blade rubbing is from the PIP2 engine, the Performance Improvement Program. And the AD requires some other things, revising the airplane flight manual. It says to provide the flight crew a revised fan ice removal procedure and a new associated mandatory flight crew briefing to reduce the likelihood of engine damage due to fan ice shedding. So apparently the fix, and I'm kind of intrigued by this, is to shave off a small portion of the inside of the fan case surrounding the fan, giving the blades a little more clearance, which would prevent the rubbing that caused the damage back in that January incident. it's kind of interesting. Usually you increase tip clearance and you decrease engine efficiency. GE Aviation has said that that is not the case here, at least in one report. So I'm not sure exactly how that works. But it's kind of unfortunate. You know, another 787 Dreamliner issue, this time with the engines.
Does make you wonder, because usually there's a trade-off. You know, you do one thing, you get a little more of something and a little less of something else. So it seems like there would have to be some trade-off in doing this, some loss in performance or increase in maintenance cost or something.
Hmm.
Well, the article that I saw indicated that only 1/10 of an inch needs to be shaved off. And GE had said, according to this article, that that will have inconsequential effect on the fuel efficiency. I can't even wrap my mind around what 1/10 of an inch really is. I can't compare that with anything, but obviously it's not very much.
Yeah. From my engine days, 1/10 of an inch would be a lot. I mean, oftentimes what you have is an abradable material. So that as the blades, whether it's fan blades or turbine blades or some other blade, sweep, they actually abrade the material to create a very, very tight fit, because you want the gas path to be sealed. Now, maybe it's not so critical on the fan as it is in the core of the engine. But at least that's my question. That was my first question, is what's the impact? The most interesting thing to me from the AD is the AD shows the costs of compliance, and it estimates those being two actions. The flight manual revisions, they say that's an hour's worth of work at $85 an hour, so that costs $85. Rework. That's 40 hours at $85 an hour, so that's $3,400. Since this AD affects 43 787s, the cost of the manual revisions to U.S. operators would be $3,655, and reworking, shaving that inside of the fan case would be $146,200. That seems awfully small to do some work like that. But hey, that's the estimate that the FAA has.
And we all know how good the government is at estimating money.
Yes, yes. all right, let's just very, very quickly, a couple other news items. You recall that back in 2014, on July 23rd, there was the Trans-Asia Airways Flight 222 crash. That was the ATR-72 crashed into buildings during approach. This was in bad weather in Taiwan. 48 on board died. That included the two pilots. 10 people did survive. Well, the two air traffic controllers, and as well as the two pilots, have been deemed negligent. I guess they're not intending to do anything about the two pilots who died in that crash. But the two air traffic controllers have been charged. Rob, you're a former air traffic controller. Does this raise the hairs on your neck?
Of course it does. But what listeners need to know is that these kinds of aviation events being turned into criminal trials is not that unusual outside the United States. We talk a great deal about how much we don't like the FAA sometimes, and how much we don't how much we might support some of the concepts the NTSB comes up with. But you don't have attorneys out there chasing controllers and pilots when they've made a mistake, because we all know that you're never going to fix the system if everybody's afraid to talk or to take any kind of action. But outside the U.S., it's a different story.
Yes.
And, of course, pilots have been charged. I had the famous case down in Brazil where a mid-air collision occurred, and those pilots were charged. I don't remember the outcome. Do you, Rob?
Yeah, they eventually left Brazil, and the Brazilians tried them and found them guilty in absentia and sentenced them to something. But of course, the two pilots never returned to Brazil, and there wasn't a prayer in hell that the U.S. was going to extradite them.
If I remember that case correctly, the mid-air collision was actually the fault of the controllers, and the controllers were not charged. It was the American pilots that were charged.
Yeah, that's absolutely right.
Yeah,
and I know two of the people that were on that airplane, on the Legacy, before it went down in the jungle. I mean, everybody on the Legacy lived. And I just saw one of them last week down in Florida. And I said, we were talking about it at dinner. And I said, what happened during the collision? He said, we didn't have one indication that we had struck anybody or anything.
Huh.
All I know is that we were sitting in the cabin and things were fine. And suddenly, essentially, life was going to hell in a handbasket with the guys yelling up front in the cockpit. And that's all they knew. However, listeners might remember too, the Legacy sheared a chunk of the wing off of the 737 and it spun into the ground and took everybody with it.
All right. One last item. This would be something that I think Aunt Benet might pick up for her, strange but true aviation stories. FedEx worker falls asleep in plane's cargo compartment, wakes up in Lubbock, Texas.
There's the punishment right there.
Yeah, Lubbock, Texas. I figure this guy's in a lot of trouble.
Can you imagine being in the cockpit when the knock came on the door? I mean, you think about the history of incidents on FedEx, flights. I think those guys probably didn't let him in. It's like, oh, never mind. Stay where you are.
I mean, that's exactly what happened.
Was he in the main cabin cargo, or was he below deck in a cargo compartment?
Yeah, it says he knocked on the closed cockpit door and had to inform the captain that he had inadvertently gone from ground crew to flight crew.
the poor guy.
Considering an incident that FedEx had with a crazy pilot who attacked he was jump seating and he attacked operational crew with an axe, I'm sure they were less than thrilled about this.
Yeah, yes. Exactly. I don't think that guy was a pilot. I think he was an employee, but I don't think he was a pilot. But you're right. That was a terrible, terrible incident. And I think all those gentlemen had to retire because of medical injuries. And it was quite a miracle that they could fight him off and get the plane back on the ground.
You know, and what's interesting about that is that incident was part of this Air Investigation or Mayday series that we see on Smithsonian Channel many years ago. And if I remember right, the pilot actually did a barrel roll with the DC-10 to try to cause the attacker to lose, obviously, whatever balance he had during the barrel roll. I can't even imagine how that was going on in the cockpit.
No, crazy. All right. Well, Scott, let's talk a little bit about Liam. We're, of course, familiar with the Liam news. And in fact, from time to time, we quote some of the articles that we find there, some of the posts. And I think a lot of our listeners are also familiar with Liam news. But for those who aren't, can you give us a little rundown of what the organization is like and the value you bring to aviation?
Well, the value that I bring would be in the eyes of the beholder. Liam News and Comment at liamnews.com is one of two elements of Liam Company business. We do consulting through Liam Company, and then we do the news and comment as an affiliation of that, but as an entirely separate product line. Our approach is that if you want news and you have the internet, you can get news everywhere, and a lot of it is obviously free. Aviation Week has a paywall element. Flight International has a paywall element. Obviously, Wall Street Journal has a paywall element. But, a fair amount of the stuff is free. But we want to bring what we term the value added, and that is to comment or to provide analysis of what's out there rather than, my going to an event and simply reporting what everybody else is reporting as well, what's the story behind the headline? And so that's how we try to approach it and provide a value add. We have a paywall element, we have a free wall element, and we typically publish one article every Monday through Friday. Sometimes there are two or three, depending on what's going on. And, you know, for example, whenever there's an aviation accident, you've got those boobs over on CNN who, you know, just really are an embarrassment to themselves and to a bona fide news network. Whereas we try to say, here are the 5 or 6 or 10 or 12 things that investigators will routinely look at. They'll look at weather conditions. They'll look at the cockpit crew history. They'll look at the maintenance history. And we try to, rather than jump to a conclusion, point people in a direction that they'll look at. If we have, you know, something like the Delta Airlines Bombardier prospect that will should know the outcome here very shortly, instead of just simply regurgitating what Reuters or Bloomberg or Wall Street Journal does, we'll try to bring some insight to that. On this MAX 7X, for example, we'll be taking a little bit more detailed look behind our paywall on Wednesday about that, rather than just simply repeating what John Ostrower so was so good about breaking the news about. And we've got some information that I don't think John got, but we had the benefit of following up on John on that. And so we'll be taking a look at things of like that. And so it's all trying to get an analysis or comment behind the headline rather than simply repeating what you can read anywhere else on the internet.
Rob, somewhat similarly, I think that when you're appearing, you know, in the media, when there's an accident or, you know, some aviation event, I think similarly, you try to stick to the facts and not speculate based on, you know, getting ratings.
Well, you know, I have to be honest. I've never had any of the media. Of course, I've done more with NBC and Fox than I've done with CNN, but never have I ever had anybody say, well, you know, let's make sure that, you know, you keep the conversation nice and juicy so it makes good news. And because very often I think the value to somebody like Scott or, you know, humbly myself, is that when you say something that is from the gut and you're honest and you often differ from the lunatics, that alone makes the moderator go, what? Wow, I didn't know that. And that's the important part, I think. But I do agree with Scott because I also know a few of those people on CNN and they're a little interesting.
You know, and it's also, too, I was once a guest on Lou Dobbs' show when he was still on I think he was still on CNN at the time, and he was railing about outsourcing, particularly outside the country. And it was clear that he wanted me to validate his underlying thesis. And to be sure, there are elements of outsourcing that I don't like, but I also look at it from the standpoint that from a company's point of view, and in this case we're talking about Boeing and the 787, there are good, valid tactical and strategic reasons to do some outsourcing, and I never was invited back.
Oh, really?
Huh. Yeah.
Isn't that funny? And here we have stories today about how Boeing is going to start manufacturing or essentially repping more of its own parts than they used to try to curb that. But, you know, it is what it is, and it's like we've talked about on a lot of issues. I may not particularly from an individual standpoint like some of the directions that companies take, but you know what? If the law is the law or the tax laws are the tax laws that allow them to do that and they take advantage of it and the people keep buying their stuff, it's not a whole lot for us to say.
Well, you know, I live here in Seattle, and so obviously I get an overexposure to IAM-751 and SPIA who get really exercised over the fact that Boeing will often move jobs out of Puget Sound to one of the other Boeing locations in California and in St. Louis or Oklahoma or wherever. And I, you know, absolutely appreciate their point of view. But I also look at the Boeing corporate point of view. And in Boeing's case, you have a declining defense business because of sequestration, because the wars, you know, have ostensibly wound down and all of that. They're losing contracts to Lockheed and others. And so if you're going to keep your facilities and your personnel busy, you have to take some of your commercial work and spread it around. And, you know, they like to talk about being one Boeing. Well, St. Louis, which is the headquarters for their defense business, which is declining, they got some of the 777X work. And that's how you keep the engineers in St. Louis busy. They move some work down to Southern California after the C-17 finally had its last delivery. They moved Boeing Commercial Aviation Services down to Long Beach, I think it was. Might have been one of the other facilities down there. But anyhow, I absolutely understand and I absolutely get why Chicago makes some of the decisions that it does. And I absolutely understand and I absolutely get why SPIA and 751 members go ape about it.
Sure. We've talked a little bit about the possible impending layoffs at Boeing. Do you have any sort of current thoughts on that? Is that something that is real and necessary, or is it positioning by Boeing? Any thoughts?
Yeah. You know, part of it is that when you have a 100-year-old company, and Boeing is 100 years old this July,
yes,
you have a production system that has built up, it's evolved. And in Boeing's case, they've tried to make it more efficient by making moving lines on the 737 and the 767 and on the 777. But nonetheless, Airbus is only 40 years old. And they started, you know, doing more automation sooner because their products are newer. And so Boeing has what I view to be an inherent inefficiency built up simply because it's part of a 100-year-old company. Now, Airbus produces on a per-plane count, they produce more airplanes per employee than does Boeing commercial airplanes we're talking about. And I think part of it is because Airbus is more automated. I mean, you just have a brand-new factory down in Mobile, Alabama, which replicates the one in Hamburg, which replicates and the one in China replicates Hamburg as well. Toulouse tends to be less efficient on the A320 line because Toulouse was the France's aerospace center. You know, that's where the Concorde was built over in France. And I've been to the Toulouse line, and that's not as efficient as the Hamburg line. So Boeing has that same issue, and they've got, you know, the old 737, they've got the old 767, they've got the old 777. You know, the 787 line is new and modern, but it was so screwed up in its execution that I kind of put that in a box by itself. But Boeing is automating the 777X. They are automating the 737 MAX, but they still have these inefficiencies. So, yeah, they need to, I think, reduce the headcount, but they also need to reduce the headcount within the administration, the management, and the non-touch labor and the non-engineering lines, I think, more than they do on the front line, so to speak.
Interesting. I know we've only got a few minutes of your time left, Scott, but before we let you go. Max Trescott, wasn't there an interesting item that you saw in the news about Norwegian that Scott might have some comments on?
Well, and I don't have it pulled right up here, but it said something along the lines of some of the U.S. air carriers being really upset with Norwegian coming into the U.S. providing low-cost transatlantic flights. And as I recall, the article said that this was a Norwegian subsidiary that was going to be based in Ireland, which was going to give them some labor advantages at lower cost for their crews.
Yeah, well, the U.S. carriers have always whined about new competition. When we had deregulation back in 1979, they whined about deregulation and all the new airlines that would come up from that. When Freddie Laker started his transatlantic SkyTrain, Pan Am, TWA, British Airways, and British Caledonian got in all of a twist on that. I don't have a lot of sympathy for people who complain about new entrants.
Yeah, it's easy to cry foul. I think in this case, the domestic carriers, the U.S. carriers, are saying that it's not fair because this airline can choose. And I'm looking at a Business Insider article, can choose a home base only to take advantage of labor laws that allow it to undercut its competitors. And the likes of Delta, United, and American Airlines can't just pick up and move in response. So,
oh, the system is rigged. The delegates are rigged. Oh, my gosh, this is just unfair.
Yeah, we've heard this a lot recently. So
I was going to say, I think the system's rigged.
Yeah, it's not fair.
Yeah, it's right. Out to get us.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry.
Isn't that what everybody's 2 and 3 year old say as well? It's not fair.
Yeah.
Something like that. Yeah. As I said before, I may not personally like it, but you know what? If the law is there, whether it's in the U.S. or somewhere else, and it is what it is, and a company is clever enough or smart enough to take advantage of it, well, then you better be more clever, I guess.
That's right. Yeah. Deal with it by competing. Not by complaining.
This is huge.
Yes. All right. So we what kind of trouble we get into here when we delve too deep into politics, and we got twinges of that coming. So before we get in trouble, we'll again thank Scott Hamilton, Liam News. Scott, tell our listeners again where they can find Liam and take advantage of all the great stuff that you guys produce.
Yeah, the news and comment can be found at lehamnews.com, lehamnews.com. And be sure and check out the subscription page. That's where you can actually buy the paywall.
Very good. Scott, again, thanks for coming on the Airplane Geeks podcast. We really appreciate your opinions and your take no prisoners kind of approach to the topics of the day. We really, really appreciate it. Thanks again.
Wait a minute. Before Scott goes, you mean we're not going to ask him what kind of a president he thinks Donald Trump is going to make?
No, we're not.
Oh, okay.
We're definitely not. All right. Thanks, Scott.
I actually like the one for 42.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I have a primary coming up tomorrow as we record this here in Connecticut, and I doubt that my little vote or even Connecticut's in general will make much of a difference. But
but my state will.
That Pennsylvania might be different. That's right. Are you going to vote in the primary, David?
I haven't missed an election primary or full since I was 18. You don't think I'm going to vote tomorrow?
Good for you. Very good. Well, David, let's talk a little bit about your recent trip to NASA Langley. What can you tell us about it?
Well,
David, tell them how you were dressed.
You're welcome for the free advertising.
Okay, thank you.
It said Airplane Geeks on it.
Well, that was a serious comment. What's Rob referring to?
I was wearing a Comavia shirt that said Airplane Geeks on it.
I don't have a Comavia shirt.
Well, I just mentioned that, but you need to talk to His Majesty about that.
Well, that's because you're not as cool as David is, Max.
I guess not.
Yeah.
All right.
Which Max are you talking to here now?
Me.
Clearly. Yeah,
David, tell us about it.
Well, Friday, we drove down Thursday night. I drove the 6.5 hours, and it turned into 9 hours because some idiot threw a box out on the Woodrow Wilson drawbridge that had wires and tape and looked a little like a bomb, and they shut down the bridge for 8 hours. So my trip down was a little longer than I was expected, but I spent all day under escort of Kathy at Langley Research Center. I've got about 2 hours worth of interviews on various topics, from blended wooden bodies to artificial intelligence, that Max and I are going to have to figure out how we're going to play. And then Saturday morning, I went over to the air show. The highlight for me at the air show was I got to see a Eurofighter Typhoon, which conveniently broke on its way back to Great Britain. So it was there as static display. So I got to see a Typhoon. Uh-huh. And Peter should be very proud of me. I also learned from the crown crew how to tell between a tranche 1, 2, or 3. So,
What's that?
The production blocks are called tranches.
Oh, for the Typhoon?
For the Typhoon, for the Eurofighter.
Ah.
And then I went over, and since I was credentialed media, I got escorted over to meet the F-35 Lightning II pilots. Luke Atwater, who is a instructor pilot for the F-35, and then Will Andriotta, who actually, believe it or not, is the heritage flight pilot and the demo pilot. Two different interviews. Luke will talk a little bit more about flying the airplane. Will get a little bit more about flying F-35s with things like P-51s and P-38s. So I guess with that, Max, take it away.
This is David at Air Power over Hampton Roads, and we've been privileged to meet some of the Air Force's hotshot pilots flying the newest fighter. I'm here with Luke Atwater, whose privilege has been flying the F-35 for a year now. Thank you for being on Airplane Geek.
Hey, thanks. My pleasure.
So we were talking just before we got started recording. You transferred from the Strike Eagle. How was that transition?
So obviously the Strike Eagle is a multi-person aircraft, so it's got a WISO in the back, a weapons systems officer. So the first couple sorties, learning how to use the target pod myself, which is primarily in my previous life, it was a job for the WISO. It took some getting used to, but the F-35 is mech'd really well. The Strike Eagle is, an older aircraft. It was designed, and then a lot of stuff was put into it versus where, the F-35 now, everybody kind of brought all the systems and integration together. It's a lot easier to use. So I found the transition actually pretty easy, a lot easier than I was expecting. So the target pod, the air-to-surface radar, the air-to-air radar, it's all fused together and into one kind of scope, whereas previously I'd have to look at multiple scopes, paging through different menus to find the information I wanted, whereas now it's all just in one place. So
nice. So you're not getting information overload from all the new systems?
You can choose to have information overload if you're not smart about picking what you want displayed to you. But it's totally customizable. You can pick layers of different information you want in terms of what sources of data do you want to get and look at on your scope. So it's actually pretty easy.
How do you like flying her?
It's a lot, I guess, lonelier flying by myself, but it's nice. It's a lot more freedom up there, but it kind of flies like a Strike Eagle. It buffets under AOA like the Strike Eagle does, so it provides a lot of feedback to the pilot in terms of maneuvering your aircraft. It's about the same performance as the Strike Eagle if I had to like put a rough guess on it. So it was pretty easy to transition to that as well.
So you've completed the transition. You're now with the F-35 flight team. You think this is going to be the aircraft you retire in?
Yeah, for sure. There was, probably 5 or 6 years ago, the Air Force was sending guys to the F-35 for a tour, and they'd send them back to their old aircraft. And that's not happening anymore. We're producing F-35s at a high enough rate that we need to keep everybody in the community that we send here. And it's going to be actually a challenge, just like every other community in the Air Force, to man it to the appropriate level. So with that, we're starting the B course, or basically taking guys right out of pilot training, 23, 24-year-old first lieutenant, second lieutenant types into the jet. So that's starting to happen. There's no way for me to get back in the Strike Eagle, and that's perfectly fine with me.
You talk about B classes and stuff. Tell me a little bit about your career. How'd you get in the Air Force and your progression up through the Strike Eagle and F-35?
Yeah, so I joined Air Force ROTC when I went into college in 2002, and that was due to 9/11 happening. I wanted to get involved with the military and go deploy and support all that. So I went through ROTC from 2002 to 2006, got a pilot slot through there, went to Laughlin for pilot training, and out of that, I got selected to fly the Strike Eagle. So from the Strike Eagle, I went to the basic course training, which is what we're going to start in the F-35. It happens for the Strike Eagle, it happens in North Carolina. So did that.
Seymour Johnson. One of our favorite bases.
Right on. All right. It was a good time there. And then I went to England for 5 years to fly at RAF Lake and Eath. Did three deployments there. One to Italy to support Odyssey Dawn. And then another to South Korea. And then my last was for Enduring Freedom. And then made the transition here.
So you're not going to give up the F-35, huh?
No way, yeah. I'm sticking with this jet for sure.
Well, I appreciate your service. Thank you for your time, and thank you for being on Airplane Geek.
Hey, not a problem. Thanks a lot.
David, when Luke talks about the plane buffeting under AOA, what's he talking about?
High angle of attack. When you're doing ground strikes or and you're doing pull-ups and stuff, the F-15 is notorious for buffeting, and evidently the F-35 does the same thing.
So our next little interview here from David is with Will Andriotta and Heritage Flight. Tell us what Heritage Flight means.
Heritage Flight was started actually about for the 50th anniversary of the United States Air Force. And what it is combining historical aircraft, i.e. warbirds, with modern aircraft. So this weekend's Heritage Flight at Air Power over Hampton Roads consisted of an F-22, an F-35, and a P-51 Mustang. They do a series of photo passes, as then they do some formation flying. And depending upon the air show, those aircraft can change. One thing we talked about with Will was Fort Worth's show where they flew a P-38 Lightning with an F-35 Lightning II. So that was a really kind of cool. And the Lightning II this year, the F-35, is the first time it's been included in the Heritage Flight. So we've had F-22s. The last time I was at Langley, the Heritage Flight consisted of B-51, an F-86, an F-4 Phantom, and an F-22. So that was in formation. And if you Google Heritage Flight, you'll see lots of different permutations. It's kind of like the legacy flights that the Navy adopted. It all stems back from the Navy coming up with something with the Kalamazoo Air Museum called the Cat Flight, which was the F-14, the F-4F, the F-6F, the F-8F, the F-7F, and then the F-14, commonly known as the Cat Flight, the Hellcat, Wildcat, Tiger Cat, and Tomcat. So that's what started it. The Air Force picked it up on the 50th anniversary and continued with it. And there's usually in late February, early March, out in Arizona, there is Heritage Flight training. So the Warbird pilots, as well as the pilots, the demo pilots for the Air Force, have a meet, and they learn to fly the formations and learn how the different aircraft react, because it's a mixed aircraft formation. So it's a little different than flying just with another P-51. You're flying with jet aircraft of various types, including warbird jet aircraft like F-86s.
All right, here's David's interview.
We're here with Will Andriotta, Major Andriotta. Thank you for being on Airplane Geeks.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, you fly the F-35. Which is really cool, but you also fly the F-35 in a very special way. You're part of the F-35 demo team and the Heritage Flight. Tell me a little bit about integrating the newest fighter into flying with Mustangs and P-38s, and what's that like?
It's really an honor. Our job and the whole point of the Heritage Flight is to honor the past, show people the present of Air Force Aviation, and with the F-35 especially, show them the future of Air Force Aviation. So it's really an honor to get up there, and if you think about it, the P-51, that was the greatest fighter of its generation. It's kind of like passing that torch now to almost the F-35, which is going to be the greatest fighter of our generation.
But you're not doing the Heritage Flight I liked. I saw the photographs of the Lightning and the Lightning II. What's it like flying an F-35 with a two-engine P-38? How much training did you do, and what was the workup like for that?
So we did a course down at Davis-Monthan. It was a week-long course in which we did all different formations with all different aircraft. It was all two-ship, three-ship, four-ship. We did an F-35 and P-38 down there. And then actually at our last air show at Luke, which was about 2.5 weeks ago, we did an F-35 and P-38. And it's really cool to do a heritage flight with basically our namesake. We're the F-35 Lightning II, and we had the P-38 Lightning I there. So it was really awesome to see how the technology has increased between the P-38 and the F-35.
How does the F-35 handle in the mixed formations?
It handles awesome. You know, it handles really well at high speed. It handles really well at low speed. It's really no issue when it comes to flying. We don't always fly slow. I mean, we're looking at 210, 220 knots with a lot of these planes, but it handles, it's so easy with the digital flight controls we have on this plane. And they basically do all the work. I just put an input in, and the plane takes care of the rest.
Tell me a little bit about your career. How did you arrive at the F-35?
So I graduated Arizona State University in 2004. I went straight into pilot training. Out of pilot training, Air Force pilot training, I ended up getting F-16s. And then I spent about 9 years of my career flying F-16s and transitioned over to the F-35 2.5 years ago as part of the initial cadre at Luke Air Force Base, where we stood up the formal training unit for F-35s. And I've been at Luke basically ever since.
What was it like for the transition between the 16 and the 35?
You know, it's actually with the way the academics are and the way the simulators are and how advanced the simulators are, it was actually pretty easy in terms of the transition. The plane itself is really easy to fly. You know, really what takes the most amount of work is utilizing all the sensors we have on the plane and actually figuring out how to read it all, because there is so much information that this plane brings to you that other planes just don't have. So that was really the big jump. Flying, no problem. You know, landing this plane, it was really no issue. It was all really the looking at the sensors.
Talk to me a little bit about what we're going to see today. I was fortunate enough to witness it yesterday on the other side of the field over at NASA with the 22 and the Mustang and the 35. Tell me how it works up and maybe go into a little detail for our pilot geeks of what it's like to get into the formations and out of the formations, etc.
Yeah, absolutely. So we'll take off and then we'll rejoin with the P-51, and that'll be us, the F-22 and the P-51. We'll rejoin, and then it's a 3-pass profile, and each pass is aimed at giving viewers a different look at the aircraft. So the first pass is what we call an arcing pass. It'll basically be seeing more top of the jet. You'll see the F-35 on the left wing, the F-22 on the right wing, and then the P-51 will be leading. We'll come back around, and that'll be a right-to-left pass. We'll come back around and do a left-to-right, what we call a flat pass, so level pass, and in which case we'll bring the P-51 with the F-35 on the left wing, and we'll bring the F-22 over to the left wing, and we'll do one flat pass. And then really what the coolest pass is when we bring it back around and we go over the crowd. We reorganize the formation back to the original, which is what we call kind of the BIC formation of the P-51 leading, F-22 on the right, F-35 on the left. We come over the crowd, we break away from each other, we pull up, and then we do a roll, and then we come back in and we do a couple passes for everybody. So that's really the 3-pass profile. It's really a great program, as I said before, to kind of showcase the past, present, and future of Air Force Aviation.
Well, I know you're busy and you got to go fly a jet, which you're very lucky. But thank you for being on Airplane Geek.
Thanks, appreciate it.
Great stuff, David. So I have a question. So you saw the F-22 and the F-35 flying in formation with the other planes. But between those two, the 22 and the 35, what did that look like? What was your impression seeing those two in the air together?
The F-22 is a better looking airplane. I can't believe I'm saying that. I've never been fond of the 22. It was the first time I've ever seen an F-35 actually fly.
Yeah.
And it's like when the first time I saw the F-22, it's going to take some getting used to. It's a different shape than what we're used to looking at with F-15s and F-16s. It's kind of tubular. It's just a different looking shape. I'm sure that 10 years from now, I'll be completely bored with it. But it was a unique profile. But if I have to look at the three aircraft, the one I'm going to focus on for the most part will be the Mustang. I'm sorry, but that's just me. But I think the F-22 is a bit sexier than the F-35. And the F-35A isn't my favorite version. I think the Navy got it right with the bigger wings and the bigger control surfaces. So it's a little different. It doesn't look as tubular as the B's and the A's. So I still think I'm partial to the C. I haven't seen the C fly yet, but it still was really cool seeing an F-35 fly in formation with a Mustang and an F-22.
Yeah.
And to say I was in front of NASA Langley's hangar that was designed for a B-36 while I was doing it was even cooler. So that while I didn't get any photographs because I was locked, unfortunately, they moved a bunch of Raptors into the NASA hangar, so we couldn't actually take photographs there. It was neat to be able to say that I was saw the formation come directly over me and do the barrel roll breaks. So it was very cool. And if anybody gets the opportunity to see the Heritage Flight, it's a really neat way of celebrating our history here. Any of them. If you're going, the one that I'd like to see this year that is the big news is their Louisiana Barksdale is going to do a B-17, B-29, B-52 Heritage Flight.
That would be impressive. All right. Well, thanks, David. Appreciate it. As David mentioned, he's got a lot of other interviews from the NASA side, I guess. Right, David?
Absolutely.
And we'll be bringing those to you in one form or another. Maybe we'll do a special episode or something, but we'll definitely be bringing those to you. And again, thanks for that, David. All right. We received a short recording, an interview that Launchpad Marzari, our good friend Launchpad, this is an interview that he did with Richie, who is the head of the Airbowl Air Gators. And what this little interview points out is, you know, there are cool jobs in aviation other than being a pilot in the cockpit. Richie has an interesting job supporting the Red Bull Air Races. And so let's give Launchpad Marzari and Richie a listen right now.
This is Air Geeks reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari, and I'm here with my new friend, Richie from Austria, who's with Red Bull Air Racing, and he is the Airgate controller, which of Deutsch would be Luftgatemeister. And he's here to tell us all about the pylons that they've brought to Sun and Fun to demonstrate the Red Bull Air Races.
Hello, everybody. This is Richie. I'm a part of the team from the Air Gators. We are here at the Sun and Fun Festival for air show. We have here Kirby Chambliss, Mike Gullion from the World Series. We do a setup we make a racetrack and they have a fly-through in the next 2 days.
Roger, and we all know about the pilots in the race, but I want to concentrate on the air gate and your support. This is the actual air gate. In fact, from here, you're going to close it down and ship it to the next race, which is in Spielberg in a week, correct?
Actually, yeah. The next race is in Spielberg, and this is our original pylon we use in the World Series.
Cool. Now, I understand that it normally has a 18-horse fan in the center and sits on a platform for even faster inflation than the light ones you've brought here.
Yeah, that's the setup we have here. It's the old system. We use blower boxes. Normally, now we have inside a charger, a blower with an 18-horsepower engine that we can raise up the pressure to 12 millibars in 10 to 12 seconds.
And how tall is it?
It's 82 feet, that's 25 meters. The whole pylon is separated in 9 parts. You can see it on the zippers. We call it from the T1 to the T9. So if a pilot comes and hits the pylon, we exactly know what is the broken part. So we have spare parts with us. So we zip the broken part off, zip the new part on, refill everything with air, and in 90 seconds everything is fresh.
Well, I think you've got a pretty cool gig going here where you get to go to the air shows, you get to go to the Red Bull races, and you know, hang out. What's your impression of Sun and Fun?
Sun and Fun is a big, big festival. I really appreciate to be here, to be part of it, and hopefully come back next year.
All right. Well, we wanted to concentrate on some part of aviation that doesn't involve actual pilotage, and you've got a pretty cool aviation job. So this is Brad Marzari and
Richie,
and we're saying so long from your friends here at Sun and Fun.
So thanks to Launchpad Marzari for sending that along. We really appreciate that. We've got a few photos in the show notes that will illustrate this, the Red Bull Air Races and these pylons. And we want to thank the Red Bull organization for granting us permission to use the photos. So you'll find those in the show notes at airplanegeeks.com/398. Wanted to mention one item. This came to us from Jet City Star, actually in the Slack listener team. The Puget Sound Business Journal is looking for a full-time aerospace reporter. So if you're interested in taking a look and maybe applying for this job, you could find yourself in Seattle being an aerospace reporter. We'll have a link in the show notes, but basically it's journalismjobs.com/job-listings/162-9619. So try that if you're interested in becoming a full-time aerospace reporter. Another item from our Slack listener team, this came from Mick. Mick always finds interesting things. He says, want to buy a used plane? This guy who has a sickness, you know the type, he says, he has aviitis. He's real bad, but he has to sell his collection of derelict aircraft. This is something called the Derelict Aircraft Museum. The website is the derelictaircraftmuseum.com. You can check that out. It's an interesting site, a lot of interesting photographs there, and it's basically a guy who's collected a huge number of derelict aircraft of various sorts. So thanks to Mick for passing that on. All right, some of the listener mail that we receive. Nate wrote us and said he's just catching up on the last couple of episodes. He says, I thought I might be able to provide some help in response to Launchpad Marzari's comments on the Spartan executive and rising costs of aircraft. And that was back in episode 395. So Nate tells us that after World War II, everyone thought that owning an aircraft would be the norm, much like what happened with cars after World War I. As you know, he says, that idea never realized, and after the war, there was a huge surplus of aircraft, which led to declining costs of ownership for several years. One large factor in the rising costs of aircraft was the California Supreme Court's decision in 1963 on the rule of strict liability, which placed the burden of liability back on manufacturers. That meant that manufacturers were held liable for harm that their products caused, regardless of customer negligence. It wasn't long before other states followed the same ruling. This led manufacturers to build liability insurance costs into the manufacturing costs of each plane. As we all know, liability claims eventually led to a complete halt on nearly all GA production. It wasn't until President Clinton signed the General Aviation Revitalization Act in 1994, limiting the extent of certain manufacturers' liabilities, that manufacturing resumed. Now, he says, all this information can be found in Snorri Gudmundsson's book, General Aviation Aircraft Design. He was an engineer at Cirrus for many years and has provided a complete reference on anything you could ever want to know about manufacturing and design of GA aircraft. The second chapter is devoted entirely to GA aircraft cost estimating methods. In there, he provides an example comparison of costs between a composite and metal aircraft design. Based on his examples, using the Eastlake model of estimation, The three single largest factors in the current costs of aircraft are, here they are. One, manufacturing labor. It says that's nearly 50% of the cost. Second is actually tied with third. Second is liability insurance, which is 12 to 17%, which is pretty significant. And the third is certification costs, which are similar to liability insurance costs, he says. So Nate says, again, I'd highly recommend getting your hands on the book. It's more of a college-level textbook, but if you're like me and have to know everything there is to know about aircraft, this is a great reference. So we have a link to that, the General Aviation Aircraft Design book. I have a link in the show notes.
I went out and took a look at that. Have you researched the book at all?
Only a little. What did you find, Max?
Well, you can actually read a surprising amount of it online at Amazon, you know, the peek inside the book.
Right.
It's really, really, really excellent. My background's electrical engineering, but I always get a kind of wish if I had a second career would be in, aeronautical engineering. And it's just fascinating. It's chock full of all kinds of great information. So I was really impressed.
Cool. All right. We also received an email from Emily. And she writes that their client, DKC, decided to write a blog post about their client, Delta Airlines, and give a little history to an already widely known brand. So I have a link to this. This is Throwback Thursday, the history of Delta. And it goes into some detail about the early days of Delta. And I don't know about you guys, but I actually didn't know where the name Delta came from, but along the way, it's a reference to the Mississippi Delta. Did you guys know about that? David, were you aware of that? Of course, that's commercial, so maybe you don't know.
Actually, I did know that.
Okay. Can't play Stump David, huh?
Considering a 2.5-year-old's first flight was on a Delta DC-9 to Alabama, I'm kind of fond of that their airline and the widget and my very first flight.
Wow. Well, that's pretty cool.
Hey, can we say nice things about Delta while we're on the subject here?
We can say nice things about any airline we'd like to.
I just want to point out, I think they're great. I applaud their CEO for the critical thinking because they're the one major airline that is not supporting privatization of ATC. So it's nice to see one airline that doesn't have a herd mentality and is not just doing what other airlines are doing because it looks like it must be worthwhile if everybody else is doing it. So anyway, I applaud them for the critical thinking and not running with the herd on the ATC privatization.
All right. Okay, just one shout out that I'd like to do before we close. When I was talking about the experience at Aviation Geek Fest in the Seattle area, I don't think I mentioned the seaplane flight that some of us went on. This was from Kenmore Air, and they offer, amongst other things, a Seattle Scenic Flight Tour. It's sort of a 20-minute narrated flight around Seattle. Which is just spectacular. My first trip in a plane with floats, they have a de Havilland Canada DHC-2 Beaver. They also have a de Havilland Canada DHC-3 Otter. Great experience. Rob, I know you've been in a float plane.
I was lucky enough to spend a day at the seaplane base at Vancouver and watch that place. And it's kind of like well, not quite Teterboro, but it's a busy, busy seaplane base, and it was really impressive. They even got their own tower and stuff there. But seaplanes are pretty cool.
They absolutely are. I think Kenmore Air, but they might fly up there to Vancouver because they do a lot absolutely. More than just scenic tours. But what a great way to get out of the water, get in a plane, and fly around the waterfront, fly around the city, past the Space Needle, hugely enjoyable. And my first seaplane ride, and I want to thank Isaac Alexander for arranging that.
Can I give a shout out that we've gotten 6 entries into the history segment for episode 400, and we've still got a little bit, a couple more days left. So go back to episode 397 to see the rules and send me your request for the airplane of the week.
Yes, and you have to go back to look at the rules in the show notes because if you just do it from memory, you might forget something that's
will null and void your entry.
That's right. So go back to airplanegeeks.com/397. Take a look at the rules, and which are not onerous or anything, but
But they're kind of fun.
Yes, they're absolutely fun. Take a look at them and submit your request to David for an airplane of the week for our 400th anniversary episode. All right, with that, I will thank all of you for listening to this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. Our guest was Scott Hamilton, editor of Leeham News and Comment. Find that at leehamnews.com. They're also on Twitter at Leeham News, and they have a Facebook page as well, so you can check out all those. Want to thank Scott.
Not spelled like the Irish first name. It's L-E-E-H-A-M.
Right, correct. All right, let's tell everyone where they can find us online. Max Trescott, we will start with you. Where do folks find you?
They can find me at the usual spots, maxtrescott.com or g1000book.com or Facebook and Twitter.
And Rob Mark?
Any place that has jet wine in the name is where I tend to hang out. Just haven't figured out a way to put that on the street corner near my home yet, though.
You know, I gave Isaac my last jet wine button when I was in Seattle.
Oh, no.
And he wore it the whole weekend. So.
Oh, cool.
Right front and center, too. Yep.
Isaac, if you're listening, thank you.
All right. David Vanderhoof, where do folks find you?
You can find me on our Slack team, listener team. And unlike the other two co-hosts who were just speaking, and the third one who isn't there. And also, you can find me on Friday mornings with the UAV Digest with Max Flight.
And, yeah, last Friday we got it out a little bit late, but yeah, no, normally it's the mornings.
I didn't notice. I was busy.
You were a little busy. Again, I'm Max Flight. You can find me on Twitter as Max Flight, on LinkedIn, as David mentioned, at the UAVDigest.com. Also, the PAX X podcast with Mary Kirby. We just recorded an episode that, if it's not out this evening, should be any moment now, with Philip Robinson. He is the aero patent guy. We've talked about some of his postings of interesting patents associated with aviation. He tracks those, so look for that show. Find us at airplanegeeks.com. You'll see there the links to all the social media places where you can find us, as well as how to contact us. We have a donate button there if you'd like to help support the show financially. We greatly appreciate it. Our intro music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. Outro by Bruno Massone. Find more of his compositions that incorporate aviation sounds at brunomassone.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Night, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
And thanks for listening. We'll be right back.